You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
All right. Well, welcome, everybody. In a second, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panelists, and then we'll get started in the discussion. We are extremely fortunate today not only to have a really outstanding and expert panel, but we also have a little bit of breaking news, at least breaking news for the legal, tech, and policy community, in that in the last day, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in Microsoft versus United States, also known as the Microsoft Ireland case. The court reversed the district court opinion and ruled for Microsoft that the Stored Communications Act does not extend extraterritorially. Our panel today is going to focus on a broader range of issues than this one case, but I expect that at least a couple of our panelists will have some comment to offer. The case addresses but one of a broader range of issues that the U.S. government, industry, civil society, and others have been wrestling with regarding digital data and law. And this web of interconnected issues boils down to this. With the increasing global nature of digital communications, cloud-based storage and services, and multinational companies and businesses, the U.S. and many other countries' laws are having trouble keeping up. I don't think I'm presuming too much to say that there is fairly consistent agreement from all of these various stakeholders that the laws can probably do better to address issues like government requests for data for law enforcement purposes. The question going forward then, and what we expect to be able to discuss today, is what are the precise problems that need to be fixed? And what are the most effective proposals going forward for doing so? So with that, I'd like to introduce briefly, just by name and title, our panelists. If you'd like to see their full bios, they're available on the Internet Caucus's website, and I would encourage you to do so because this is a really terrific group. Starting to my side here is Andrew Woods, an assistant professor of law at the University of Kentucky School of Law. Moving on to his side is Brad Wiegman, Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division at the Department of Justice. Greg Nogheim, Senior Counsel for the Center for Democracy and Technology. Margaret Stewart Nagel, Head of America's Government Affairs for Yahoo. And Kevin Adams, the First Secretary of Home Affairs for the Embassy of the United Kingdom. So this is a really expert panel, and we have a lot to discuss. With that, I'm going to start off, actually, with our industry representative, Margaret Stewart Nagel, and ask you, Margaret, to provide us with a snapshot of the challenges that U.S. companies are currently facing when it comes to data that has international touch points.
Thanks so much, Carrie, and thanks to Net Caucus for hosting this panel today. I think, you know, as I think through the challenges that companies are facing today, in an environment where data is global, countries have interest in law enforcement requests for data that is global, laws aren't keeping up, and there are often conflicts, and so I think it might help to start a little bit with sort of how we're operating today. So generally, when foreign governments are looking for the contents of communications from a U.S. internet company like Yahoo to investigate a crime in their local domain, they have to go through a process like MLAT. Because the Stored Communications Act prevents the companies from sharing contents of communications with third parties with limited exceptions. And right now, the MLAT process is burdened heavily because, particularly in the U.S., because there are so many requests coming in for U.S. companies' information because of the sort of the success of U.S. internet companies around the world, and we have so many users around the world. I think in an environment where this is happening, the burden is not likely sustainable. And as a result, we're seeing companies being put in a position of having to make choices between different countries' laws. We're seeing countries propose laws and pass laws that assert jurisdiction over companies outside of their borders. We're seeing proposals and laws requiring data localization. We're seeing company executives being arrested in countries, and these are all outcomes that are over time going to create a race to the bottom for privacy protections for our users, and are not sustainable, frankly. And so, I think. You know, what we're seeing today, if we see those proposals and those laws become the law in certain countries, it is likely that other countries will follow. And so we're very concerned about sort of the precedential nature of some of these proposals and the world that we will be living in down the road. And so I don't think the status quo that we exist in today, where a lot of the U.S. protections for due process and privacy that are in place for U.S. countries or U.S. companies and sort of de facto in place for our users around the world, it's not clear to me that that's a sustainable future. And so I think we need to think about ways that will create those kinds of protections in a global environment. And because the privacy of our users is critically important to us, and we want to ensure that we are protecting them and their data. And so I will, you know, there's been a lot of really great work on these issues by folks on this panel and others. And I will allow them to talk more in more detail about some of the proposals that are out there. But I will say that I think MLAT will continue to be, the MLAT process will continue to be an important process going forward. And so I'm appreciative of the work that DOJ has started doing in terms of modernizing and providing additional resources to MLAT, because I do think that that is going to continue to be an important tool for governments and for companies. But I do think that there's additional room for a framework where countries that follow, you know, internationally established human rights protections, privacy protections, due process, can come together and create a new way to work through this process. And so I hope that we can continue this conversation. And I do have some, you know, I have further thoughts on the kinds of requirements that we would want to see in those agreements. But I'm happy to defer to others to start off that conversation.
Okay, so let's pause there, because I think what we want to do at first is we want to really identify what is the problem set that industry and sort of everybody represented at this table is trying to solve. And just very quickly, I heard you describe the MLAT process, conflict of laws, data localization, legal jeopardy for company executives as just a few of part of the problem set. I want to turn now to Kevin Adams from the UK, because obviously this is a global issue. Kevin, can you help us augment the picture of the problem set from the UK perspective?
Yes, thank you. So I agree with much of what Margaret said about the current situation being unsustainable. I mean, we think it's very bad for other governments, for law enforcement, for privacy, and for companies, as Margaret has said. But to say a bit more about specifically the problem that UK law enforcement face. So I think he's partly stating the obvious, but data, electronic data, is increasingly stored overseas, much of it in the US. And UK law enforcement and security agencies need targeted, reasonable access to the data in particular circumstances in order to tackle the most serious crimes, including terrorism. And they increasingly cannot get it because of where a company is sort of choose to store it, or where it happens to be located. So the UK law is clear that the companies doing business in the UK have a requirement to comply with UK targeted warrants. But increasingly, a conflict of laws means that companies are put in sort of conflicting legal demands and are unable to comply. So, I mean, to be very specific, what we're talking about is targeted warrants that have gone through a UK sort of rigorous process, identified a sort of public safety risk or a serious crime such as child sexual exploitation, arms and drugs trafficking, terrorism investigation. And those sort of crimes, increasingly access to data is absolutely vital in order to disrupt, to investigate, or to secure a prosecution. And we're talking as well of cases where there is very little sort of link to the US other than the data happens to be stored here. So we're talking about serious crimes of the sorts I've mentioned where the perpetrators, the suspects, and the victims may all be located in the UK. And the only link to the US is the fact that the data happens to be stored. And to give a statistic of our serious crime requests, companies are only able to reply to about 4% of those because of the conflict of laws that exists. So we think this is a completely unsustainable solution. We want a way consistent with good rule of law, a way that promotes good standards for oversight, transparency, privacy protection. We want a way that preserves a sort of open and free internet, but that also gives law enforcement and security agencies targeted sort of proportionate access to the data that they need to do their job and protect the public. And the current system now incentivizes really the opposite, incentivizes, we've heard, data localization, other attempts to get access that data that's less privacy protective. So I've got some more thoughts on Solution UK, but in terms of the problem, I'll leave it there.
Okay, so I want to turn now to Brad Wiegman from the Department of Justice. Brad, the Department of Justice, other government entities have been working with relevant stakeholders, industry, foreign government representatives, and others who are interested in the privacy and civil liberties issues on thinking about these problems. So it's no secret that that process has been ongoing. Can you talk about sort of what is the current thinking as far as the framework going forward? What can we see in terms of some solutions to the problems that have been identified going forward?
Thanks, Carrie. So for the reasons that Margaret and Kevin identified, we've been working with both the UK government, with industry, with civil society. We've been discussing these issues and trying to come up with a new way to solve the problems, tackle the problems they just identified. And what we have talked about is a new framework where basically we have an international agreement with foreign governments like the UK if we conclude that government has adequate commitment to the rule of law, adequate protections for privacy and civil liberties, a robust surveillance law, so they meet the requirements that we would set forth, that we're comfortable that they have an adequate regime for obtaining access to the data. And if they are not targeting for their surveillance activities or the information they're trying to collect any U.S. person or any person in the United States, that they could then serve process directly on a company like Yahoo or Microsoft or Google or whatever it might be, and obtain the data for their investigations of serious crime, so crimes like terrorism, arms trafficking, child pornography, et cetera. So it would be a little bit different than the MLAT process because they wouldn't be coming to the U.S. government. They'd be going directly to the providers, and the providers would then be relieved of the bar that they now have in U.S. law and producing that data in response to a foreign order. So right now there are bars in both the Stored Communications Act and the Wiretap Act that would otherwise prevent companies from producing data in response to a foreign order. And so what we would need is the agreement, but also legislation that would say if you're operating under one of these agreements and it meets the conditions that the government sets forth that are specified in the agreement, then we're going to lift those bars and we're going to allow the companies to produce the data in response to foreign orders, just as they do today. We already have for U.S. orders. We have exceptions in U.S. law for U.S. demands under the Wiretap Act and Stored Communications Act. And we would say if a foreign government is operating pursuant to one of these agreements, then they could produce data in response to a foreign order as well. So that's the basic framework. We have been working on legislation on this issue. It's almost ready for release. It could be released in the very near future. Some of you I see in the room, we've briefed on this concept in the past, and we do plan to have the legislation available and public in the very near term. I thought I'd just take a few minutes to identify some other features of the legislation that will be important. One is that this doesn't create any new authority for any government to collect data, nor does it compel a U.S. company to do anything. It doesn't compel them to comply with an order. It doesn't create any new authority for the U.K. or any other government to get access to data or for the U.S. government to get access. All it does is eliminate that bar that I talked about, that conflict in U.S. law, so that companies are then free to comply, if they should so choose, with an order from the U.K. or another government with which they have this agreement, but it doesn't require them to do so. So that's an important point. Second, we have a number of features built in to address privacy concerns that we would otherwise have, because even though we're not targeting, again, U.S. persons or any person in the United States, so that's the first major protection for privacy of folks here, we still have an interest in the privacy of non-U.S. persons overseas, so we have provisions that would be built in to say, okay, the foreign government can't, let's say, have an investigation that would be First Amendment-protected activity here in the U.S., so that investigation would not be covered by the agreement, or they couldn't do bulk collection of data. We're talking about targeted, specific, particular investigations of activity here that would be required. We have requirements that the foreign law would have to be involve some sort of independent oversight by a judge, authorization by a judge or some other independent authority to ensure that it's not just a blank check for the executive in the foreign government to issue the order. A prohibition on what we call reverse targeting. So this is the idea that you're really interested in someone in the United States or a U.S. person, but you're targeting a foreign person with surveillance in order to get that person's communications. So that would be forbidden. So you can see, I can go through some other ones if you're interested in, but you see we've built in a number of provisions into the legislation and in the agreement to kind of address privacy concerns.
Fred, can I ask you one quick follow-up as you're going through this? So we've just, a few of you, you've all mentioned, I think, the MLAT process. Can you just take a minute and explain what the MLAT process is?
Sure. So the current process, MLAT, for those of you who don't know, stands for Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty. So these are treaties that we have with another number of governments around the world. And the way the process works today is if the UK wanted to get an order, wanted to obtain stored communications for, let's say, as Kevin mentioned, someone involved in investigated in a child pornography case in the UK, they would have to get their order in the UK under their law and go establish that they met their legal requirements, bring that to the United States. We would then, to the Department of Justice, we have an office that then processes those requests, make sure that they then meet our standards of probable cause, meet U.S. legal standards in addition to U.K. legal standards, take that to a judge in the United States, obtain the warrant to obtain the data, then that's served on the company, essentially, and the company can produce the data. So it's a more cumbersome and lengthy process. It involves requirements to meet both foreign law and U.S. law. It takes a long time, and to be honest, a lot of foreign governments aren't familiar with U.S. legal standards. So things like probable cause or alien concepts all throughout Europe, they have other standards. It's necessary and proportionate. It's analogous to probable cause, but it's not the same. And so it causes a lot of delays and challenges for foreign governments in seeking data.
Okay, and so if I understand, to go back to sort of the legislative framework that you all have been working on, so this would sort of, for companies that meet the criteria, would enable countries to not have to go
through that
MLAT process?
That's right.
Okay.
Two other things I would say, because I'll move on, let other folks talk because we have limited time. Mm-hmm. These agreements would be reciprocal, so we would have the same right to go directly to UK companies, and this is something we think will increasingly be important. So it would be even Stephen on this side, if there's a company in the UK that we need to get access for our criminal investigations, we would have the same authority. And then last, there would be oversight of all of this. We set up this structure, but we would have annual audits or requirements to make sure that they're following the rules. And I should also say minimization procedures, and let me explain what that is briefly. A minimization procedure is, even though we know that the UK in this instance would be targeting foreign nationals located overseas, it's possible they could get U.S. person information because those people could be communicating with people in the United States. And so we would require them to have rules governing how they're going to deal with that U.S. person information, when it can be disseminated, what the restrictions are on keeping it, retaining it, and so forth. So we would have special protections for that type of information. So that's the basic structure. Let me just comment, and I'll wrap up by saying why we think these agreements are in our interest. One is, to the extent that we can make our partners, like the UK or the French government or the Germans or whoever we enter into these agreements with, more effective in prosecuting crime, including terrorism and other serious crimes, we think that makes Americans safer and better off. And you can only see the like attacks like the ones in Nice yesterday where some Americans were killed in addition to many other foreigners, why it's important for our partners to have effective access to data in order for their investigation. So it does help us directly. Two, it helps our companies avoid the conflicts that we talked about, avoid the enforcement actions, the arrests, the other things that Margaret talks about, and gives them a way through where they can cooperate with foreign governments in a more effective manner, protect their customers' privacy, ensure that we have adequate rules for getting the data, but also comply in an effective and efficient manner when governments have a legitimate need for the information. Three, we avoid data localization. Avoid efforts if we can't come up with a structure where countries are going to say, you've got to store your data here, because otherwise we're not going to have effective access to it, so you've got to store it here. I think that'd be bad, Margaret can tell you, for business, for a whole host of reasons, even beyond government reasons, so data localization is a problem. Agreements like this would help address that. The reciprocal benefits for the U.S. government I mentioned, if we can reach out and get data overseas, right now there's more data here in the U.S. than there is overseas, but increasingly that's not going to be the case, and it'll be important for us for our own investigations to be able to reach out and have an effective way to get data abroad. Last, and this is an important point, is privacy. I think this can actually advance privacy because countries are going to want to have these agreements. In order for them to be eligible, some of them will have to raise their game. If they have aspects of their surveillance law or their commitments to how they criminal trials that are not adequate, we're going to have to say you have to raise your standards in order to be eligible for such an agreement. So it could actually have the impact of increasing privacy protections in foreign governments overseas. So with that, I'll stop and let Carrie move on.
Great. Okay. So we're going to come back to more of the sort of reaction and thoughts of everybody on the proposals. But I do want to pause because this highlights sort of all the different variations of the issues that are involved. Because so far we've been talking about foreign government access to data either held here in the United States or held by U.S. companies. The decision that came down yesterday in the so-called Microsoft Ireland case pertains to U.S. government requests for data held by a U.S. company outside of the United States. The data was held on servers in Ireland. So I want to turn to Greg Nogheim of CDT. Greg, can you talk about the Microsoft case from the perspective of what, from CDT's perspective and your perspective, was sort of the main point that came out of that decision yesterday? And this, again, was a Court of Appeals decision of the Second Circuit.
Yes, I can. But before I do that, I do want to comment on the approach that approaches that we've been talking about, which is to basically use these bilateral agreements to bypass the MLAT system. The important thing to keep in mind, and the way to look at this, is that we'd be basically swapping out the U.S. law for the foreign law applied to the demands made by the foreign country. That should make people think, well, what is the foreign law that would be swapped out for? And when it comes up short in terms of the civil liberties protections that are now attendant to the MLAT system by the operation of the U.S. law, which of those are we going to build in and which of those are we not? And I'll get into those criteria in just, I think, in the Q&A, in a later Q&A part. I will say this also. What's contemplated is unprecedented. It would make it so that foreign governments could conduct wiretapping in the United States. That means conduct real-time surveillance, something that is not permitted under current law, has never been permitted through any MLAT arrangement, and I think is something that Congress ought to reject. That said, I do think that it is worth looking at this approach to these bilateral agreements. I think Congress should examine the possibility that this would ease some of the pressure on the current system, because the alternatives are not good. And it is correct that the current system will not scale. So with that said, let me turn to the Microsoft Ireland case. What happened was a three-judge panel of the Second Circuit in New York ruled that warrants issued by U.S. judges do not reach data stored outside the United States. It's a complete victory for Microsoft, which had lost in the case below, and which CDT supported with an amicus brief, CDT, my organization, with an amicus brief. In fact, most of the tech industry got behind Microsoft in this case. I think it's important that the decision avoids a really bad scenario that would have resulted had it gone the other way. And the bad scenario is this. If U.S. warrants reach data stored outside the United States, well, then so do U.K. warrants. U.K. law already says they do, and U.S. providers resist. And so does the law of other countries. They would all follow suit and say their process reaches data stored in the United States. It would have been the Wild West, and I'm glad that the court went in the other direction and avoided that outcome. The court's decision stresses the privacy purpose of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. It looked through the whole decision, looks at ECPA through the privacy lens, which I think is an important rejection of the DOJ position, which was that the court ought to look at ECPA as a disclosure statute to law enforcement. That said, I think that the decision creates additional impetus for solving this cross-border issue. DOJ cannot issue warrants now, at least in the Second Circuit, that reach data outside the United States. That will mean that there is an additional incentive to do something about the need for DOJ to get access to that data when it is stored abroad. I think it also, I think we should also be thinking about how companies will respond to the decision, how users will respond to the decision. Are users going to put more pressure on companies, users particularly abroad, to store data outside the United States in local, in the countries where now it's clear only local process would apply? Or will and how will companies react to that? So I think that there's a lot of questions from that case. I think that it's going to, I'm sure it's going to be appealed. Maybe those questions won't be answered for a few years. But it does make this issue, I think, even more important.
Thanks. So let me turn to Andrew. Can you respond a little bit to sort of Greg's take on the opinion? Some folks have characterized the opinion as, and it just came out yesterday, so, you know, a lot of stakeholders are still in the process of really sort of reviewing it thinking about what its impact will be, because the opinion itself raised a lot of different issues. But what's sort of your quick take on it and your quick reaction? And also, talk a little bit about what Greg mentioned regarding the worry about data localization, because we've heard, I think, almost everybody mention, I think there's universal concern that that perhaps this decision, maybe not, but sort of some of these proposals might go in the direction of data localization.
Yeah, sure. So first, thanks to you for moderating, and thanks to NetCaucus for having us here, and thanks to Greg for that nice summary of the Microsoft case. Interestingly, I think Greg and I share the goal of maximizing privacy on the Internet, and I read the case very differently. Greg's response is actually pretty similar to what I would say is the modal tweet about the case. So the modal tweet goes something like this. Big privacy victory for the Internet today. And then there's a link to an article about the case. And I'm not sure that it's a big privacy victory for the Internet. In fact, I'm not sure it's a win for privacy. I'm not sure it's a win for the tech industry, which Greg characterized it as. It's clearly a win for Microsoft, but maybe not the whole industry. And I'm not sure it's a win for policy on the Internet. So let me just say a word about each of those. Is it a win for privacy, in which the case is being celebrated as? Just, I think, because the United States government was rebuffed in attempts to get access to data. We were in this very unfortunate place in our privacy debate where when the U.S. government loses, privacy advocates, I think, reflexively celebrate. Doesn't necessarily mean the decision is pro-privacy. What really happens in the case is that the court decides that the Stored Communications Act does not apply to Microsoft's Irish servers, which means that American search and seizure law does not apply to Microsoft's Irish servers. Irish law does. So the privacy advocates that are celebrating this victory are celebrating the fact that Irish law will apply to this data, not American law. That's not usually the stance that privacy advocates take. Usually they say, as Greg did a minute ago, American privacy law is wonderful. And if you look at the debate over the US-UK contemplated agreement, privacy law advocates will say just the opposite of what they say in response to the Microsoft Ireland case, which is, it would be a disaster if we let the local law of privacy in, let's say, Ireland govern access to data. It ought to be U.S. law, which is robust. If you think U.S. law is robust, I think you ought to read the U.S. The Microsoft Ireland case as a loss of privacy. Secondly, is the case a win for the tech industry? I don't think it is. It's very clearly a Microsoft win. And a number have seen some tweets that say, you can tell that Twitter is the only place I get my information. I've seen tweets that say that look at all the amici that signed on. This was the tech industry versus the United States government. It's really not. The biggest amici that signed on in addition to Microsoft were, in addition to Apple, telecoms like AT&T and Verizon, whose profit base and networks are structured very much within territorial boundaries of the states in which they operate. They're not structured as global networks. There are three enormous tech companies who you might characterize as almost the entirety of the tech sector who did not file amicus briefs in that case. Yahoo, Facebook, and Google. Why didn't Yahoo, Facebook, and Google file amicus briefs in this case that's so important to the tech sector? The answer, I think, is that they have structured their networks and their business model as global operations, and they do not endorse the Second Circuit's ruling that the right jurisdictional test for which states ought to be able to get access to data is the mere location of the data. Okay? So I don't think it's fair to characterize this decision as a clear win for privacy or a clear win for the entire tech industry. And then finally, I'm worried that it's not the right policy outcome. I share a lot of the concerns that were aired in Judge Lynch's concurrence about the case's implications, because essentially the case reifies the principle that the location of data is what matters in terms of asserting jurisdiction over that data, not the location of the crime or the suspect of the company or the citizenship of the victim or the citizenship of the suspect, all relevant bases for asserting jurisdiction in other areas. But here the court says what matters is the location of the data. That core principle is the core principle behind data localization policies. So when Margaret mentions that this case might set a dangerous precedent internationally, the dangerous precedent it sets is, here's the world's most powerful country saying to other countries, yes, what matters is where the data is stored. So Brazil and Russia and India that are contemplating, or in Russia's case, implementing data localization policies, full steam ahead. That's the way you get access to data. The way you assert jurisdiction over data is to make sure that it's within your territorial borders, because it's stored on servers locally. That's a really scary world to me. I prefer a world in which we've developed thoughtful, human rights-respecting agreements, like the one, the US-UK agreement that's contemplated, where we reduce jurisdictional boundaries and implement rule of law structures for deciding when and how governments get access to data, not just relying on where the data is stored.
So you raise a really important point, which is that this is not just about the U.S. and the U.K. And so if I can turn, I want to turn back to maybe Kevin and then Margaret to comment on the fact that this framework, as I understand it, will rely on the implementation of agreements between two countries. How practical is it for a new framework, which we all understand to involve a global network of communications, to rely on individual negotiations of agreements between two countries? Kevin, maybe if you want to start, and then Margaret and others, if you have thoughts as well.
Sure, thanks. So I think Andrew made some important points, and I won't sort of repeat them in the interest of time. But I will also just pick up on a couple of points that Greg made as well. I mean, certainly for the UK, we've talked about MLAP, but certainly for the UK, this is not about undermining or bypassing the MLAD arrangements. Certainly will sort of complement them for the first obvious purpose that what we envisage under this agreement is a more narrow range of circumstances in which we would request data than is possible under the mutual legal assistance arrangements. But the mutual legal assistance treaty, it takes several months, typically between 9 months and a year, to get a response. And that can work where you are post-crime seeking data for evidence in a prosecution. But it doesn't do anything for the investigations where you're trying to prevent and disrupt an ongoing and very serious harm, whether it is a terrorist plot or abuse of children or an arms and drug trafficking case. So this is not about undermining the mutual legal assistance. It's about it's really about complementing it. But on your question of is it practical? I mean, we think the UK's view is that it is. Obviously, what the first one is going to be quite a lot of work because that is why it's important to get that right. In our view, establish those really high standards and that really sound framework to establish that baseline for future agreements. So we think it is practical. But also taking your point about the UK, sort of which country standards apply. It seems logical to me that when you are talking about a risk to a particular country in the UK, whether it's a serious crime with the victims in the UK or a plot or a serious trafficking case in the UK, it is going to be British law and British processes that are able to establish whether it is reasonable, proportionate in those circumstances to have access to that data. So, and just to say something about the UK law, I mean, we view the UK law, like the US, has extremely high standards for when data can be requested, a very sort of world-leading oversight and transparent regime for what powers security agencies have and how they can be used. And the UK at the moment is revising its law. The Investigatory Powers Bill is in Parliament. And that privacy is absolutely at the heart of that bill. It's absolutely clear that interception warrants cannot be granted if that data can be obtained in a less intrusive way. And there's a number of measures in that, but one I think very significant I draw your attention to is for the first time there will be judicial authorization of warrants in the UK. Typically in the UK, a Secretary of State has exercised that function, and that's partly a sort of history of our political legal system, that ministers, secretaries of state are accountable to Parliament for the actions of the executive. But we recognize it's important to actually bring a sort of judicial authorization of warrants as well, so that there will be a double lock. Secretary of State will sign a warrant, but also a judge will have to approve that before that warrant can be executed.
And just a point of clarification, are you speaking to law enforcement warrants or law enforcement and on the national security side?
So all most intrusive warrants would be approved by the Secretary of State and a judge. But this is where I think it's important, and I think it's a point Greg made about it's sort of transplanting one law for the other. I mean, our vision for how an agreement would work is that essentially you have a double lock as well. First of all, you have the country's laws, who are the country that is law enforcement is making the request. So in the case of the UK, it would have to satisfy the very rigorous sort of processes in place to establish necessity and proportionality. Data can't be obtained any other way. And then, so you have that sort of check. And then secondly, you have the specific arrangements that are in the agreement itself and in whatever sort of criteria Congress chooses to lay down, that similarly, in what circumstances the agreement could be used. So it may be that UK law, for example, would does permit request sort of bulk warrants. You know, it's clear that the agreement wouldn't permit the agreement to be used for that purpose. So you have the agreement, you have the protections of UK law, and then you also have the protections that are baked into the agreement and legislation.
So, Margaret, would, from the company's perspective, what's your reaction to this new framework potentially relying on these individual bilateral agreements between two countries? Does that work, or does that potentially sort of open up more issues from the company's sort of the recipient's perspective?
I don't think this is going to solve all problems in this space, but I do think that it has the potential to help move progress forward, and I think particularly if we can get to a place where the framework and the legislative proposal is strong, is privacy protecting, creates the appropriate protections, as Kevin was talking about, for both U.S. law, and creates the right standards for the U.S. government as they enter into these frameworks or these agreements with individual countries, I think they are replicable. They certainly won't be replicable in every country around the world, which is why I say I don't think this is going to solve all of our problems. That's one of the reasons why MLAT will remain an important tool for our companies, or for countries as they interact with our companies. So while I don't think it will solve all of the problems, I do think that it will solve some, if not many, of the problems that we're facing today, and certainly puts us on a better path, and gives us the potential to end up in a better place.
Now, there was a new bill that was introduced this year, if I am correct, in both the House and the Senate, which was ICPA, the International Communications Privacy Act. Margaret, maybe let me start with you, but then if others of you have thoughts, how does that fit into this puzzle?
So I think it's an important part of it. In some ways, it's the reverse part of the conversation to the framework, sort of what is being discussed with US-UK. I think one of the things that is important in ICPA is that the focus of it is really on the location of the crime and the user versus the location of the data, and I think for us that's a helpful clarification in that bill.
Anyone else? Yeah,
please. If I could just address some of the things that have been said.
Yeah.
I think Kevin is describing a bill that's pending in Parliament right now that is oceans away from the way the privacy community in the UK is describing the bill. First, when it comes to judicial authorization, today there is no judicial authorization in the UK. If the agreement that Brad described was in place today, the legislation that Brad described was in place today, UK law would not come close to qualifying because the Home Secretary issues the warrants. So it is a step forward, what they're doing on judicial authorization, but they are putting in place what is known in the UK as the judicial review standard, which is roughly analogous in the United States to the Chevron deference that you see for administrative decisions. So the primary decider will still be the executive branch. There will be a judicial review of that, but it will be deferential as opposed to what we have, what is currently the rule, which is if the UK wants data, the US applies. It applies. It doesn't make a decision. It applies to a judge for permission. So it's a very different system in that sense. Second, in the UK, there are other features of the law that have been, of the bill, that have been very concerning. One is that it allows for what's known as thematic warrants. That means warrants about people who are engaged in a common activity. That's the language of the pending legislation, as opposed to more particularized requirements. So it's important that you look closely at what DOJ puts in their legislation with respect to particularity, because that could solve that problem. With respect to the level of proof in the UK, no, it is not probable cause. And I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I do know this. Amendments were offered to require just reasonable suspicion for the surveillance. Those amendments were all rejected. So I think that we have to look very carefully at what the U.S. does in order to fill some of the gaps that we can see in the U.K. law. One other issue, notice. In U.S. law, a person is entitled to notice of the surveillance being conducted. Notice can be delayed. In the U.K. law, there's no obligation to give notice. So what ought to be the criteria for these bilateral agreements? They ought to include things like, as Brad said, would be in the legislation, judicial or other independent authorization. There ought to be a strong factual basis for believing that a crime has been committed. Particularity, which I mentioned already. The concept of legality, that means the crime has to be punishable at law. There should be notice, it can be delayed. There should be dual criminality, that means it should be a crime in both the country where the data is being sought and the country that's seeking the data. And there should be minimization to prevent the collection of irrelevant data and also to deal with the U.S. person issue. I'd add, these are all criteria that are in Andrew's post about this issue, but I would add a few things as well. There ought not to be new real-time surveillance authority. There ought to be control over leakage from the criminal side to the intelligence side. In particular, for Europeans and for people outside the United States, you wouldn't want U.S. criminal surveillance to seed Section 702 surveillance, which is conducted completely without a warrant or all the other protections, or many of the other protections that are in U.S. criminal law. We also have to deal with the metadata anomaly that's in U.S. law. This anomaly says that there is only one country on the planet that has to get a court order in order to gain access to communications traffic that is held in storage by a U.S. provider. That one country on the planet is the United States. Only the United States needs a court order. That is crazy to make it so that foreign governments can demand that data and the providers can volunteer it. We need to solve that problem. And finally, we need to have a transparent, credible mechanism for deciding which countries we're going to have these agreements with. The DOJ proposal contemplates that that mechanism will be the Department of Justice. Congress would have no role other than in setting the criteria for the agreements. I wonder if that's the right approach, as opposed to having Congress approve each of the agreements. But I do know there has to be some fair, transparent way for deciding which countries meet the criteria that will be in the U.S. law.
So in a few minutes, we're going to turn to, I want to take questions from the audience for our panelists. But before we do that, I want to turn to Brad. Could you address specifically the question or concern that Greg has raised regarding the framework allowing real-time surveillance, and then also any additional comments that you have?
So first of all, let me just say that a lot of the elements that Greg outlined are in our legislation and our agreement. So we agree that there are, have to be these minimum standards, and I think we have a lot of them in there. Not all of them, but a lot of them are in there.
Not minimum standards, Brad. Good, strong human rights standards.
Yes, whatever you want to call it. However you want to refer to them. We have a lot of these standards in the agreement. But what I would posit, what I would ask this group to remember is we are talking about surveillance efforts that are targeting non-U.S. persons located overseas. Okay, so let's posit an individual in the U.K. who is suspected of abusing a child in the U.K. The U.K. can apply its own law today and does every day to search that person's apartment, to wiretap that person's phone, to surveil that person, to do, and undertake all manner of investigative steps as is appropriate. They have an elected government. They have their own standards that their people have decided are appropriate, balancing the privacy interests of that person against the needs of their society in the U.K. Why should it be that we have to insist on U.S. probable cause standards or other U.S. standards when we want to also get something from that person's Gmail account, when it has nothing to do with the United States other than the fact that it happens to be on a server in the U.S.? That's the issue here. We're talking about non-U.S. persons overseas being investigated for crimes. All the other investigative steps that they would be taking would occur under U.K. law. Why do we insist on a higher standard when we think that if we think that their laws are adequate? We're not trying to replicate this whole – the philosophy of this whole agreement is that we're not replicating U.S. law because there are other ways in which U.K. law is more protective of U.S. law. For example, let me give you one. You can't use wiretaps in a U.K. court, period. No use at all. That would be a dramatic change in U.S. law. That's a protection they have in the U.K. that we don't have here. They don't give notice. It's against the law in the U.K. to give notice to their personnel of the surveillance. It's a difference in how they approach things. There are differences in all countries' laws all around the world. If you looked at French law and German law, Hungarian law, Japanese law, there are always going to be differences. If we're trying to replicate what U.S. standards verbatim, we're never going to succeed in this enterprise because that's the problem. That's why we're in this pickle.
Let me just
move on. On real time, let's talk about real time surveillance. As I think Kevin will tell you, the UK has a need, like every government around the world has a need, to be able to intercept communications, do wiretaps when they have established the right standards to meet their investigative needs. MLATs can't be used for that purpose, but the government needs to be able to do that. They can do it on their own phones. They can do it for email that's involving a UK provider, but they can't do it for a US provider only because it's data here. It sounds scary to say they're doing wiretaps in the US. It's no different for the company. Margaret can tell you how different it is to do a wiretap at Yahoo versus giving store communications. They're flipping a switch at Yahoo and turning the data over one way or the other, whether it's just retrospective or proactive. It's not a huge difference in terms of it actually happens. It's not UK law enforcement people coming over and putting clips on in the US. So, and wiretaps in some ways can be less invasive. Then you're only talking about future surveillance. If you're going back years into someone's email inbox, you may be getting a lot more information than you would otherwise. So real time is an important component of this. I think Kevin and other governments would tell you why it's important to them to have that, and so that's why it's been included.
So just to be clear here, what he's talking about is unprecedented. We've never had foreign governments do wiretapping in the United States. I don't think we want to go down that road. We'll have that discussion. But just to respond to some of the other things that Brad said. The reason in the UK that they don't use evidence in trials is because they think that they regard the collection, even on the criminal side, as a protected source and method, that it's actually a pro-security measure as opposed to a pro-privacy measure. I do agree, though, Brad, I think it has a privacy benefit. It's interesting, though, that all the privacy groups in the UK advocate that it be allowed to be used to take away that secrecy from the surveillance and to give the subject of the surveillance a chance to challenge.
Okay, I'm gonna turn to Andrew for a second for a quick comment, and then Kevin a quick comment, and then we're going to move to audience questions.
Thanks, Carrie. So just in response to what Greg just said, I don't think it's a fair characterization of this contemplated agreement to say that the British would be wiretapping here in the US. In fact, the British would be asking for data in Britain. They would walk into Google's offices in London and say, hey, someone was murdered in Hyde Park. A British citizen killed another British citizen in Hyde Park. We've got all the physical evidence because it's here in London. We would like now the digital evidence. A judge has said we ought to have it. That is entirely reasonable, and it's not the case that what they're doing is crossing the pond to dip into American servers. That's how it's been characterized. I don't think it's accurate. About these agreements, and I want to say a word about ICPA, if you erect barriers needlessly to states getting data in which they have a legitimate interest, you make this problem worse. Okay? And I would note, we haven't talked about encryption, but you increase the pressure that states feel to, for example, introduce backdoors into encryption. So for the US-UK agreement is something that, I've not seen a full draft, simply says US law applies here in the US and UK law applies over there, and that seems entirely reasonable to me, and it wipes away the blocking features of ICPA, which I think is quite sensible. ICPA, on the other hand, introduces new blocking features, and so ICPA isn't as simple or as well thought out, to my mind, as the contemplated US-UK agreement. ICPA says something like, if you're a foreigner here in the U.S., and someone correct me if this is wrong, but my understanding of ICPA is that if you're a foreigner here in the U.S., the U.S. government cannot, despite having gone to a judge to get a warrant, cannot get access to that foreigner's data here in the U.S. So if a foreigner comes to the U.S., plots an attack on using an American service under ICPA, the American government, despite having probable cause, can't get access to evidence related to that planned attack. That strikes me as crazy, because what it's doing is rejecting the notion of basic sovereignty that the American government ought to be able to enforce its own laws here in U.S. soil. And whenever that principle is violated, you're going to see really, really bad policies result, like governments demanding backdoors to encryption.
Okay. Kevin, quick comment, and then we'll turn to at least one first question in the second row.
Yeah, so three very quick points. But, I mean, we talk about things being unprecedented. What is really unprecedented is that law enforcement are not able to access the data that they need because of the way technology is working today. I mean, that is what is unprecedented about the situation we're facing. But three quick points. I mean, on the question of different standards, I think all countries, obviously, for their own historical, legal, political reasons, will have systems that look different. And I think this agreement is a very good opportunity to establish sort of, you know, baseline standards around human rights, protection of freedom of speech, a number of important privacy protective elements. But we should hesitate to try and see this as an opportunity to sort of export specific U.S.-specific legal terms such as probable cause to other countries. And because another country's system is different, it doesn't mean in its totality it is not of an equivalent standard. We feel very strongly that the U.K.'s is. But what is happening in the UK is a pretty unprecedented democratic process with privacy groups, with Parliament, you know, a full debate on what is the right framework, what are the right powers for UK law enforcement security agencies to have. And that is the right framework to apply situation in the UK. I mean, just on the judicial review test, I mean, I don't accept Greg's characterization of it. It is a very serious and meaningful judicial review. Even if a judge does not agree with the decision, the warrant will not go ahead, and there are various requirements on that to assess the necessity, the proportionality, the privacy, and the public privacy interests of that warrant. But I don't have time to, you know, to go through a full account of that, but happy to do so, you know, to others who are interested. But a final point on sort of live intercept or wiretaps. I think these points have largely been answered, but I'd just add two other points, that live intercept is really an absolutely vital tool to protect the public. It provides the intelligence to support operational activity that leads to arrests and prosecutions. And there are a number of circumstances where really that sort of timeliness of live intercept is what enables law enforcement to disrupt, for example, arms trafficking, drugs trafficking, where sort of timeliness is essential to stopping that harm. I mean, in some cases like kidnapping or firearms cases, it is literally the difference between life and death. And increasingly, the way we see technology changing, there are increasing services that will not be generating stored content. So it may be that live intercept is the only way to get the data in that case. But we in the UK, of course, recognise that that can be intrusive, which is why we have important protections in our law that you have to use the least intrusive means first. But I would echo the point that was made that live intercept is not always in all circumstances necessarily more intrusive than access to stored communications. For example, you know, targeted access to a particular device in a particular time frame where you have grounds to suspect a particular crime is going to take place, I would argue is far less intrusive than access to someone's entire stored content.
Okay, thank you. Let me turn to, first I've got a question right here from this lady.
Sure. Okay, yeah. So I'm Laura Ballard, I work in the State Department, I'm mostly a policy analyst, and I've been very seized with, over the past year, been doing comparative research on how surveillance oversight works in different foreign legal systems. And I've also been seized with what criteria we should apply to these kind of agreements. So Mr. Adams, I actually wanted to ask you about two countries that I've been looking at a lot recently, France and India. And the reason these countries intrigue me is that, first of all, there's a huge U.S. tech presence in each of these countries. Secondly, they're both healthy democracies. They've got a system of laws I suspect the UK probably has a special relationship with these countries, each in their own way. There's a lot of reasons to be collaborating on information sharing. And also, their system of oversight is really different from ours and the UK's. So what I'm finding is nobody uses the badge of awards probable cause outside the United States. I haven't found it yet. Almost nobody is requiring an independent judiciary to issue warrants ex ante. And when you start getting into inquisitorial justice systems, like France, where you have an investigative magistrate who themselves are ordering the production of data, it's quite a research project to figure out what is effective oversight in that system. What should I look for in that system that constitutes oversight? So my long-winded question to you is, do you have any impressions of these countries? Would the UK have the same comfort level entering into an agreement like this with France and India? Would you have any problems with our sharing UK citizens' data with those governments pursuant to a bilateral agreement that we might enter into with those countries?
So thank you for the question. It sounds like you're doing valuable work. I mean, I'm no expert on the situation in France and India, but I think you make an important point that I was trying to make earlier, that different countries, for good historical, legal, political reasons, will have different frameworks. But just because they are different doesn't mean they are better or worse. Now, of course, that is not to say that any framework is acceptable. There are important things, protecting privacy, independent oversight, transparency, and so on, that we could go on, that are important. So this agreement is an opportunity to set some of those standards. I mean, my focus here is very much on the UK and the US element of this, but I think that's an important point. On your question about US, comfortable with the US and so on, I think, you know, part of the logic of this framework is that, you know, we know the US system very well from the sort of unprecedented relationship we have between our law enforcement and security agencies and a long history of working together. So we understand each other's systems, and we have a high confidence in the US privacy protections here. So, you know, we are comfortable with the way that the US system operates to enter into an agreement like this with the US.
If I could just add on that, these agreements will not be for everyone. It's clear there are a lot of countries that are not going to meet the standards. At the same time, very important for us not to create standards that are so elaborate and so detailed and so so much of an effort to mimic exactly what's in U.S. law that no one can join the club. You know, no one can be in it because no country in the world will have adequate standards that meet some of the things that people would want to include. So I think we have to be important on both sides of that.
That said, we do need to measure the agreements and the legislation against what current rules are and understand what's changing.
For non-U.S. persons outside the United States.
There will be a blowback for U.S. persons. I'm pretty confident of that. And the blowback will come in the form of a collection done by the U.K. under U.K. rules, by France under French rules, or India under Indian rules, which won't include the same protections that are in the U.S. They won't.
But my point is they can do that.
And then a share back to the United States because the Indian surveillance or the French surveillance uncovered what the Indian government thinks is evidence of crime. Let me just finish, Brad. So there is going to be some blowback in the United States. And another thing to think about, we keep talking about the scenario where it's a U.K. crime, a U.K. citizen, and a U.K. Committed the crime and a U.K. citizen was the victim. That's not going to be the only scenario. It might not even be the primary scenario, because the way what's envisioned is that UK would get the information under UK law regardless of where that person was if they were not in the United States and regardless of their nationality if they are not a US person. So what we're talking about is taking the UK law worldwide through application to US providers who serve people worldwide. If it was just domestic in the UK, I'd be much more sympathetic to this argument that the UK people chose this surveillance regime and that we ought to just live with it because this is just affecting UK people. It's not. It's about the world.
Okay, we're running down, so I want to make sure we get at least another question or two. Yes, please.
I'm Ken Propp from the Business Software Alliance, which represents software service providers. Brad, you mentioned that legislation would be put forward quite soon. The UK is in the process of doing its counterpart legislative measure through the surveillance law right now. Can one deduce from that the agreement is actually complete at this point and it's simply the legislative step? And then the follow-on is, once your agreement is in place, how do you see the further architecture developing? I mean, we have an expansive network of MLATs that took 30 years to negotiate, and now we discover that technologically they're not suitable for many of the investigative situations. If we start with a U.S.-UK bilateral and proceed bilaterally with strict standards the way Greg has been suggesting, we could easily have a 25 or 30-year process for something that I've heard others on the panel describe as an urgent problem.
So to answer your first question, no, it's not done. Obviously, as I should have made clear from the beginning, we do require legislation. We're going to have to work with the Congress. No agreement could be complete until we know what the conditions are that Congress would be prescribing for such agreements and also to authorize them in the first place. So obviously, it's a work in progress. We'd have to work with the Hill. On your second question, it's a good one. I do think these are likely to be one-by-one labor-intensive agreements. I think they could be different with different countries. I would hope that once we have some track record under our belt, we have a template for doing one, that they will be faster as we go along. But I don't anticipate that we would be able to do a whole ton of these in a very short time period. But it remains to be seen how long it would take. One thing, just again, to respond to something that Greg had said in terms of U.S. persons being affected, they can be affected today, let's be clear, if the French or the British or the Japanese are intercepting a phone call. A U.S. person could be on the other end today. If they're getting email from a provider in the UK or France or Japan today, U.S. persons could be intercepted and their communications could be taken today under their law. If a U.S. provider is storing information in the UK, which they might have to do if we don't have an agreement of this kind, there is no regulation by the United States at all of what the standards are under which the UK gets the information. So I just ask people to keep that in mind.
Another question? In the back. Yes, please.
So, Aaron Taylor.
Right now, we think wiretapping is a key component of the proposal. Well, I was going to have to engage in discussions with the Hill, so we'll see how it goes. I've been in too many engagements on the Hill to know that never say never. We'll obviously have to have discussions with you all, your members, your staff, as to what we can do.
So from my perspective, I mean, I hope I make clear why live intercept is an absolutely essential part of this. And I think it would be a big mistake at this stage to try and sort of seal that off and not include it, because I don't think there's very good arguments for being there. And you risk making a framework that very quickly becomes out of date, because technology, again, is changing and not generating stored content. So we're at the very beginning of this process, but I think it's, for the UK, live intercept is absolutely a critical tool to protect the public. And, you know, we don't think it is the case that the sort of privacy concerns around that and around a framework that we can build is sort of justifies taking that out.
Other questions? Yes, and I think this will probably be our last one. Go ahead, please.
So clearly, following the decision on the 23rd of June, following the result of the referendum, there is now a new ministry is taking place that is going to be looking in great detail about our relationship with the European Union and what that looks like in the future. I'll just make two points. I mean, as of today and for at least 2 years, possibly more, everything stays the same. We remain a member of the European Union, subject to European law, subject to all the same regulations. So nothing has now immediately changed as a result of that, and it will be looking through what the sort of future relationship looks like. But importantly, this it doesn't impact on the bilateral agreement that we've been talking about today. Certainly our view is that the discussions we've been having and the agreement that we envisage is absolutely compatible with EU law, but it doesn't depend on it for its sort of legal base. So what our future relationship with the European Union looks like on some of these data elements is a separate question to proceeding with this agreement.
Great, thank you. So before we wrap up, I just want to mention that the Department of Justice has brought a white paper. We have hard copies available that we'll put on the table to the side of the room, a white paper describing the framework that that legislation proposal will be forthcoming soon about. So you are welcome to take a copy of that, and we'll have them available for you. With that, I'm going to wrap up the panel. Thanks again to the Internet Caucus for having us today, and thanks to all of the panelists for a terrific discussion.